the House Agricultural Committee to order. I think Representative McPherson will be along very shortly. He's been busy all day, so.
The Speaker's office last I saw.
So we're going in. I just want to say it is really a privilege for me to be sitting here and with a really outstanding group of legislators that are going to make up the agriculture, and I look forward to a really productive and great session this year on the Ag and Natural Resources Committee. And before we get started, I want to have people introduce themselves, a little bit about themselves, and if they want to do something from the standpoint of their district, and you know, just a little personal thing that maybe all of us get to know each other a little better. And we might as well, we'll start down here to my right. You notice that?
It's the far right
back
there.
How did I get over here? I don't know. I was informed on that.
Wait, I have a registration card if you're interested.
I'm representing Brian Boquist, 23rd House District. I represent five rural counties in the western half of the Willamette Valley. And I'm a returning member to the House Ag Committee, so I think every director out here knows the types of questions I'm going to ask. Thank you.
I'm Representative Jackie Dingfelder, and it's an honor to be here as well. I represent House District 45, which is Northeast Portland, and I served on the Ag and Natural Resources Committee during the interim with my esteemed colleague here as the vice chair or co-chair of that, Representative Smith. I've served for two sessions as vice chair of the Water Committee and have worked on natural resource issues for 20 years in a professional capacity.
I'm Brian Clem, House District 21, which is here in Salem, and it's all relatively urban-looking, so someone would be surprised to find me on agriculture and natural resources, but I grew up in Coos Bay, and that shapes a lot of my views and values. That was my high school principal right there. And usually when I'm hauled into his office, you know, it's sort of that same feeling, and usually I've been behaving that way. And then when I married my sweetheart, who works over in the Senate 7 years ago, her family's been growing pears and apples and cherries in Hood River for 96 years. And so I married into a farming family and help assist in running our 80-acre fruit orchard. And so it's a big area of interest for me personally.
That represents Smith
District. It is.
Yeah, it is.
And Parkdale, technically. You guys actually would know what Parkdale is.
That's right. We'll let you go next.
Thank you. I'm Representative Patty Smith. I represent District 52, which is East Multnomah, East Clackamas, and all of Hood River County. So a former chair of this great committee, and Representative Roblin, who is now chair, was my vice chair. So we go a long back, way back, and I wanted to say I thought we were very productive last session.
I agree.
So, I'm a farmer by trade, my fourth term here, and I look forward to working with all of you. Thank you very much.
I'm Representative Ron Mowers, first termer. I'm the only true freshman on the Republican side. We've got a walk-on freshman, which is Vic Gilliam, and then we have a redshirt freshman, which is Fred. Anyway, my district is 3. Josephine County represents a lot of trees. And our family background, we owned a small resaw mill in Grants Pass for a number of years. The land became much more valuable than the mill, whatever. So it's now an Albertsons and a McDonald's. Mm-hmm. And so I have an interest for my constituency regarding agriculture and natural resources.
And I'm Arnie Roblin. I'm District 9, which is Coos Bay to Florence, and I am truly honored to be here. And I was honored to work with Patty Less as the chair of Ag and Natural Resources. It has always been an interest of mine. I am, from my perspective, family, grandfather, great-grandfather was a gillnetter on the Columbia, lived in Aberdeen, Washington, and would work in come down to Astoria, had a little place on the docks there and fished. And then lumber became the big issue for our family up in the Port Angeles area. But before that, the family came from Illinois farmers. And I remember as a young child going back to the farm, and great-uncle was there, and I thought, as this little six-year-old, that this would be really fun. And he said, you know, when you're 16, come on back and you can work on the farm. And I thought, this is really great. I'm going to do that. And as soon as we got out of that house, my mother says, you will never go work on the farm. Been there, done that. You know, that's too hard to work. And I think one of the things that people need to recognize is how hard people do work in these industries day after day to make a living. But in large part, it is a choice and a way of life for them. And I hope that as we go through this session, you know, we show the respect to this industry, which has helped build Oregon. So those are the important things for me. We have on our desks, and hopefully you've had them for a little while, the rules that we're going to run the meeting by, and I would entertain a motion if anyone...
I would so move.
Please do.
I move the House rules be adopted.
Representative Smith moves the adoption of the committee rules. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Should we have our first roll call vote, or would everybody like to do this by acclamation? Let's go with a roll call vote. I like that, actually. So, seeing no discussion, let's have a roll call vote on the House rules.
Representative Boquist?
Yes.
Representative Dingfelder?
Aye.
Excused. Representative Maurer?
Yes.
Representative Quinn?
Yay.
Representative Smith?
Yes.
Chair Rowe?
We'll give you the word.
Yes. Thank you for that. And before, since I kind of went over this, we need to introduce our staff.
Oh,
that's right. Thank you.
Yeah.
It passed. Thank
rules
you.
Are adopted.
Keep doing it. Rules are adopted.
That's okay.
I appreciate it. That's right. That's right. So, but we do need to introduce our staff, and so I will let Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's been a very long time since I've sat in this seat, but I have staff committees in the past. First in 1985, and then again in 1991, I staffed this committee and the Committee on Water Policy. So I am thrilled to be back and look forward to working with all of you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brian Penn. I'll be the assistant for the committee. I've lived in Salem my whole life, and my job is to make sure we have everything recorded for public record.
Thank you. So we should close this hearing. So we're going to close the hearing, the organizational meeting, and we will open an informational meeting. So first up, we get to have some overview of some different agency programs in the Department of Agriculture. Katie and Lisa. Katie Koba and Lisa Hansen.
People we've seen before.
We have.
We have seen them.
We have
before.
Seen these people before.
Hey, Mr. Chair, she knows not to talk about wolves and cougars.
Yes, she does. We had that discussion before.
Especially if Burley's not here.
That's right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Katie Koba, Director of the Department of Agriculture, and with me is Lisa Hansen, who's the Deputy Director. And I don't even know what a wolf is. thank you for the opportunity to appear in front of the committee this afternoon and spend a little bit of time giving you an overview of our industry and some of the key issues that we think will be in front of this legislative body. We've got a short period of time, so I will go through the topics fairly quickly and then obviously look forward to answering any questions that you might have, and certainly would welcome thoughts or input on key issues that you would like to bring to our attention, and certainly as we move into the legislative session, areas where you would really like our assistance. So with that, I'm going to start with this handout that lists Oregon Department of Agriculture on the top of it, and which is a real quick overview of some of the key issues. And we actually appeared before what was in Representative Smith's committee late last year with a very similar handout. So some of you have seen it, some of you it's new, and we'll go through it again. You know, in your introductions, you talked about your ties to the natural resources industry, and certainly my sense is, in terms of serving as director, that when you talk about agriculture, there's really a strong cultural element to that industry and that state, and we talk a lot about the agricultural roots in Oregon and the fact that we have now over 1,000 family farms, which are century farms, which is just, you know, a huge number and growing every year. I have the honor of oftentimes presenting those awards at the state fair, and it's a real privilege for me to do that. And the other thing that is very, very important, I think, for the industry in Oregon is its diversity. Oregon's agriculture is as diverse as California and Florida. We're not as large, but we certainly grow the diversity of crops, and that is a strength for our industry, but it can also at times be a challenge in terms of trying to represent the various aspects that go into cranberry farming, which are dissimilar from wheat farming and yet similar to wheat farming. So trying to cover the variety of issues that our industry deals with can indeed be a challenge. In Oregon, we have right about 40,000 farms. The vast majority of those are indeed family-owned farms, with over 90% family-owned, operated, or family-owned corporations. So we are truly a family-based agricultural industry in Oregon. Very small, 1% would be considered a true corporate farm. And we talk about the industry in this state as really falling into three categories. We have small farmers. Oftentimes these are folks, you might consider them hobby farms. A lot of time they're talked about as martini farms, but people that have full-time jobs and then have a small amount of acreage, and they farm for the love and enjoyment of it. Then we have kind of the mid-sized category, the 10,000 to 250,000 in annual sales. And I would say that this is the category where our industry faces the most challenges. In terms of being able to compete in a global economy and not having the efficiency of scale. And then we have large farms that are very successful and are growing in Oregon. On the next page, you see the two charts really demonstrate that the point I was making in terms of diversity of Oregon agriculture. The first chart lists the top 10 Oregon commodities, with nursery and greenhouse being our top segment of the agricultural industry in the state, pushing nearly $1 billion in farm gate sales, which is huge. And then that's followed by cattle and calves, grass seed, milk, hay, on down the list. The second chart that you see are the places where Oregon is the number one producer of that item in the United States. So we are the number one producer of blackberries, hazelnuts, loganberries, raspberries, and those items, none of those are in the top chart. So you can see, while they're not large in terms of overall quantity, we are the largest producer in the U.S. Of those items. We talk a lot about agriculture's contribution to the environment. Representative Dingfelder, you probably know this topic much better than I do. The fact that Oregon farmers and ranchers provide food and habitat to over 70% of Oregon's wildlife. The incredible efforts that our producers have put into erosion control on cropland and rangeland. Erosion has been reduced by more than 25% in the past decade. And incredible efforts around water conservation, using water more wisely, and we'll touch on that topic here pretty quickly as well. In terms of where Oregon agriculture goes, there's a real strong growing sentiment around buy local, which I think is wonderful for our industry. It really helps in that connection with rural and urban Oregon when we've got a Portland farmers market that's seeing the growth and the sales and the folks that live in urban Portland and really want to go and buy directly from the farmer, and that's wonderful for the industry. But I think we can't overlook the reality that over 80% of what we produce in this state leaves our state's borders, and over 40% of that moves into international markets. So when I talk about markets for Oregon agriculture, I really talk about a three-legged stool. Our local market, which is the smallest percentage, but that connection and understanding and wanting to make sure that farmers and ranchers succeed in Oregon really kind of starts there, and then our domestic and our international markets. And we spend a lot of time dealing with issues on all of those. Getting Oregon agricultural products to market, I would say, is one of our top issues that we deal with in the agency and helping the industry succeed.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Sorry for interrupting.
No problem.
One question. Is it 40% overall export internationally, or 40% of the 80% that leaves the state?
40% overall.
Okay.
So it's right about 80% leaves the state. About half of that stays in the domestic market, and half of that moves into an international market.
Thank you.
So for our industry, transportation infrastructure, whether it's barging, rail, trucking, being able to get product to market in a cost-effective manner is absolutely critical. As we look to the upcoming session, I wanted to highlight certainly what we think will be topics that will be in front of you all this coming session in one form or another. A lot of discussion in the last year in terms of agricultural labor, and three big issues there. Certainly labor availability, I would say this past year was a huge issue for our industry. It's primarily a federal issue, and we are hopeful that Congress will be addressing that issue, but we did have crops this year that were not harvested because we did not have labor. And unless we can deal with that issue, we're going to, I think, be seriously impacted in the future. On a more local front, Oregon's minimum wage, particularly relative to the federal minimum wage, has been a challenge for the industry. Again, hopefully with the increase in the federal minimum wage, that will help. And then finally, collective bargaining issues around agricultural labor in Oregon has been a topic that has been in front of this body and potentially will be again this coming session. Land resources and issues, i.e. land use, another very incredibly important topic for our industry, whether it's Major 37 or the overall review of Oregon's land use system. Our producers and ranchers' ability to remain competitive in Oregon has some direct, land use has a direct impact on that. And we in the industry are conflicted on this topic. There are strong sense of private property rights, but at the same time, when we have development going into farm and ranch land, it impacts our farmers and ranchers' ability to do their job. Kind of a new issue on the horizon for us is the issue around air quality, and there will be a piece of legislation that is introduced by the department on this topic, potentially could come to your committee. But right now, Oregon's agricultural industry, with the exception of field burning, is exempt from the Federal Clean Air Act. And this piece of legislation would tweak that exemption to bring Oregon in line with the Federal Clean Air Act. We spent a lot of time working with the industry on this issue, and I think it's very important in terms of how we handle it this legislative session. On the back page, water issues, both in terms of quality and quantity, again, a very important and I think emerging, growing issue of concern for the industry. We in the agency have been dealing with agricultural water quality for over 10 years now. Very proud of our program and, again, our farmers and ranchers who are doing great things on the ground to address water quality issues. The issue of water quantity, I think this session will be something that you hear a lot about. And bottom line, it is something that we in Oregon have to deal with, certainly from an agricultural standpoint, but even broader than that. We are getting to the point where we just don't have enough water to meet all of the demands. And so we've got to be smarter about capturing water and using water and using water as an economic development tool. Renewable energy, Representative Dingfelder, I can turn it over to you. Certainly great opportunities this session, and for the industry, it's an area of incredible opportunity, and we're very excited about being involved in that discussion and where it might go for the agricultural industry in terms of providing an alternative for making money, bottom line. So with that, Mr. Chair, why don't I pause to see if there are questions on that, and then we can move to our list of legislative concepts.
That'd be great. Any questions? Seeing none.
Okay. The second page is a list of our legislative concepts, and we're starting to get them dropped in terms of bills, but we haven't got the bill numbers on here yet, and we can certainly, your committee will know that as well as we will. But I will run through these. I'm not going to go into detail on every one of them. I'd like to highlight some of them that are of more importance to our agency anyway. The first concept, LC 805, regulation of biopharmaceutical crops. This was an issue that came before the legislature last session with some concerns about the potential of raising pharmaceuticals in plants
and how we can manage that in Oregon without compromising food safety or markets or other agricultural crops. So there was an interim work group that spent a lot of time on this topic, and this legislation is a result of those efforts to give the Department of Agriculture and the Health Division the authority to clearly enter into an agreement with the federal government so that we can partner with them. They are the ones that would actually receive a permit to grow a biopharmaceutical plant in Oregon, but it would allow us to enter in and review the permit application and put controls on it if we thought it was important to protect the industry. And this piece of legislation really gives us some tools so that we're able to do that. The second concept, Measure 37 exemption for the department's pest and disease control actions, and this also includes right to farm. This was a bill that we introduced last session and got caught up in all of the Measure 37 debate, and it did not go anywhere. And given where we go with Measure 37, it's hard to know whether we're going to need it eventually, but we still want to put it before the body. What it does is it clearly exempts our authorities around implementing control districts to control pests, to control diseases, and our statutory authority around right to farm, and clearly exempt them from Measure 37 claims. We think that they probably are already, and this is more a industry-to-industry concern as much as a non-ag person coming at the industry with a Measure 37 claim, and I won't go into more detail on that until we actually have the bill in front of us. The next concept would continue the agreement that was made around the Commodity Commission program 4 years ago, I believe, and in which a sunset was put in place to come back and review that. So we're bringing that legislation back and recommending that the sunset provision be removed to continue the government oversight that was put in place in order to protect commodity commissions against several lawsuits that were being filed around the country. LC 669, we actually have three fee increases that are included in our budget. This is the first of the three, which I will go over today. All of these are very, very important for our programs, and these are fee increases to continue the existing program. This is not a fee increase to enhance the program. The first is our brand inspection program, whereby we go out and inspect all transactions involving cattle to make sure that ownership is in place, and then we also deal with complaints of theft and conduct theft investigations around cattle, and we do need a fee increase in that program to continue the program. The next couple of concepts are fairly minor in nature, and I don't want to go into them in detail today. On the back page is our second fee increase proposal, and that's in our Weights and Measures division. We have the Measurement Standards division, which makes sure that all scales in the state are calibrated accurately. We also do motor fuel quality in that program. We ensure that the ping pong balls that are used in the lottery drawings are all equal and balanced and fair. It's kind of a unique program in our agency. So in terms of scales, we inspect livestock scales, we inspect scales in grocery stores, we inspect scales at Intel. Any scale in the state is inspected by the Department of Agriculture, and we need a fee increase in that program to continue our service. The next concept, LC 806, I spoke about earlier, which is the tweak of the Oregon's agricultural air quality exemption to bring agriculture in the state in line with the Federal Clean Air Act. LC 671, fee increase in our base pesticides program. This is the program that does all licensing investigations and enforcement on pesticide users. It is not a fee increase associated with the pesticide use reporting system. And the other two concepts are also pretty small in nature, so I won't touch on those today. I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Katie, there's 11 on here. Is that the total of the Ag Department's agency bill, Chip 11.
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, that's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Brian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Katie, pesticides program fee increase, what is it? So it would go to $250?
For the record, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director. Mr. Chair, Representative Klein. That would set a maximum in statute, and it's anticipated that we would increase the base pesticides fee by $50 currently. So we would still have room in statute.
What is it currently?
It's $60 total, $120 goes to the base pesticide program. So $120 for base pesticides, $40 for PERS, $160 total for each pesticide product that's registered for sale in Oregon.
So we take it to 210? 210.
Okay.
Representative Klein, nothing simple on this.
Yeah.
Wait till we get to the Cougars and Wolves.
I'm sure we pay these, too.
Right. Any other questions?
Yeah, I remember Cougars.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. We look forward to working with you.
I look forward to the
same. In a quick session.
Yes, that's true. We look forward to that as well.
We do it in 4 months.
So we could go ahead and Representative McPherson. Representative McPherson, would you like to introduce yourself to the...
I'm Representative Greg McPherson. I represent House District 38, which is Lake Oswego and part of Southwest Portland. And I think my probably strongest credential for service on this committee is that I grew up on a Linn County dairy farm, and as I'm fond of reminding my colleagues from time to time.
Thank you very much. So next we have the Department of Fish and Wildlife, Roy Elliker, Deputy Director. And a few guests.
And well, if you consider statute books gifts.
No, guests,
no,
I guess.
Not gifts.
Not gifts.
Yeah, no, not gifts.
We can take books.
We can.
Yeah.
We don't charge for those.
Oh,
okay.
Good.
No, we don't charge for those.
Zero, then.
Yeah,
we're zero. That would be tremendous.
It's the resale value.
That's what I'm saying, yeah. It's worth a lot of money, I can tell.
I'm not sure they'll be selling these on eBay.
Yeah. What? On eBay, yeah.
Negative $8.
Yeah. Who knows what you're going
to do? Good afternoon, members of the committee, Chair Roblin. For the record, my name is Roy Elliker, Deputy Director for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And Virgil Moore is in the middle of a rather large commission meeting over in our department right now, and so he will be here with me at a later date, but could not come over today. I'd like to cover some legislative concepts, and I've handed out some testimony on that. I do want to say very much pleased with the folks I have worked with for many sessions on this committee, and for those who don't know me, they'll get to know me pretty quickly since I'm in the building constantly, it seems. And I did want to start out here by talking a little bit about for every biennium, the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Department does print a statute book that we have no charge for. This is used extensively by Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Division, by many of our constituent groups, by a lot of conservation groups, and there is such a body of law that deals with fish and wildlife in this state, we think it's wise for us to have it in a separate volume. And again, we don't charge for that, and anyone that would like one, we provide that free charge. I would like to talk a little bit about our legislative concepts, and I also have some help here to do that today if we get into some questions, and in particular, Chair Roblin as well. If I've saved the best for last, if we want to talk about some legislators' favorite topics, the four-legged large canid who is about to enter Oregon, we can spend some time on that, and I have Mr. Ely help me do that. I would like to cover our four legislative concepts quickly and then take questions and move on to other issues, or then move into a little more discussion on current wolf issues in the state. And the first two concepts that are now bills, and I was lucky enough to manage to get our House bill and Senate bill numbers for these, so I've got those on here, is that the first two are fish issues. One is the revisions to our fish screening passage program, our landowner's cost share program. The second is revisions to our marine developmental fisheries program. And our first one, House Bill 2994, is the fish screening passage program, and that was started back in 91. It's a very successful and one of the oldest cost-share programs that our department uses. It's been responsible for the screening of hundreds of small and large water diversions to protect fish from going down into irrigation ditches or into hydroelectric facilities and returning those unharmed back to the water body they came from. It started out as a very small program. In fact, it got started in 1989 when the legislature asked the department to go back and take a hard look at this issue. There had been laws on the books since 1898 to protect fish, but there's at the time a lot of support from sportsmen and the irrigation community to really get a harder look at the issues regarding the loss of small, for instance, salmon and steelhead smolts down irrigation canals. And in 1989, the department went back and we produced a priority list of 3,500 unscreened water diversions that were not protected for fish loss. We used that in 1991 to start a pilot program, and it was really strong, supported by a number of conservation groups and sportsmen who came together and put together a very small cost share program. The legislature blessed. Essentially, it added a 25-cent surcharge on every fishing license, so the sportsmen would help pay for this, as well as some general fund. And basically, it's a 60-40 program, so any water diverter under what we call 30 cubic feet per second, a water diversion of under that, which is a small size, any water diverter who would like to participate, who wanted to participate in this program, could fill out an application, and the department, through this cost-share program, would pay 60% of the cost of the installation of the facility, and the landowner would pay the other 40%. And that has been very successful. The program became permanent in 1995 and put in statute, and in 1999 with the addition of the Oregon plan, the program really received a big shot in the arm of about $4 million biennium now from OWEB funds, and the program has expanded to include more federal money, more state money, more private money. And so at this point, because the statutes were written for that very small pilot program and essentially never changed from back 91, and you look at the size and the extent and the program that is now, it was time just to take those statutes and bring them up to date. So nobody claim later we're violating statute by providing cost share funds on larger projects and those kind of things. So that's essentially what this legislative concept is about. And upon page one, it lays out a couple of the minor things, like, for instance, the fish screening goals will be changed to use the option of water flow rate versus number of water diversions screened. And here's a good example. For instance, when the law was written, it said that the goal of the program, or the goal of the program, should be 75 screened diversions a year. But the problem was it didn't say whether these would be one or two CFS diversions or very large diversions of, 30 or 60 or 200 cubic feet per second diversions. So as the program's expanded, and we've done larger and larger diversions, but under the old statutory formula to count what we're supposed to achieve, one CFS water diversion is equivalent to one 1,000 CFS water diversion. So statutorily, we're not meeting our goal, when in fact, we are, if you look at total water flow or volume or anything else. So that's an example of how we're going to modify those to get those more up to date. And I've got the rest of those changes there. Probably another one of interest to the committee is that, at the time, the program limited inspection of minor maintenance costs to $25, essentially, and it goes unspecified. I guess that's either per landowner or per visit, how you'd like to do that. Well, it costs much more than that for us if the thing is broken up, for us to go back and do an inspection. On major maintenance issues, the landowner is not responsible for major maintenance as well. And so we need to make some changes to this. And the landowner community, we have a fish screening task force, a group of advisors. We've worked with closely on this group of revisions, and they're very supportive, as well as the irrigation community and sportsman community. So we're going to bring you a good package on that. Let me move quickly on developmental fisheries program. This is another housekeeping revision. On the middle of page two, you'll see that, and developmental fisheries, when we use that term, it's a marine program term. We're basically talking a situation where a group of fishermen or a fisherman decides that he wants to go out and try and make money on harvesting a certain fisheries resource. The best example I know is, for instance, our bay clams, also called quahogs and clams like that. And so we had a couple fishermen that found a market for that and designed a special harvesting tool that used kind of a power tool rather than hand raking. So they've been involved for a number of years in the program. There's three or four now folks that have these bait clam permits, and the fishery's been developed under this program with careful supervision by us. So some of the things, for instance, when we get into this issue is, you know, when a fisherman comes and says, I've been working in developing this fishery, but, you know, the problem gets to be if he develops his fishery and all his friends jump in, then, of course, he loses all his investment. So the program's designed to help protect and kind of incubate in development of fisheries and protect those individuals who go out and pioneer those. And some examples of fisheries that are big now that once were little were like sardines, also sea urchins, and then, of course, right now on the list we currently have what we call hagfish, which is a big slimy fish that lives deep in the ocean, but there's a considerable Asian market for it. As well as spot prawns, box crab, and there's about 12 other species. So anyway, we're gonna come and with this bill make some changes, essentially housekeeping changes to the program. But since the program's in statute, we can't do that by rule. The last two are wildlife concepts. The one, and Mr. Steve Denny here is here from Roseburg, happens to be here for a commission meeting, but I thought I'd bring him along in case your questions on this. Landowner Preference Program is a program first put together in 1989 statewide and then revised again in 1995, which allows landowners of certain size lands and above to hunt on their own property. Currently, a lot of big game hunting in the state is you have to apply for a certain unit and get a certain permit to hunt that unit, and that's done to achieve good ratios of males and females. So when we got started with all this control hunting, all the landowners who actually own property in the area said, look, we need a way to be able to hunt our own property and allow our family to hunt our own property. And over the years, that's also morphed and learned about is that, you know, during the year, a lot of landowners have damage, whether it's from, particularly from big game, elk and deer, or other animals, geese, but particularly for big game, and that's what this program is designed for. Designed to allow, now the program's been changed a little bit in 95, to allow landowners during the year to take those animals, harvest those animals that are causing damage on their wheat fields, on their orchards, or whatever, and take care of the problem like that. What we had developed, though, about 2099 in that area is that down in southwest Oregon, because we have a real checkerboard pattern of small landowners and big landowners, private landowners, we found that we had a real problem with elk. The elk would come in on the small landowners, feed at night, destroy orchards or wheat or whatever was down there, and then be moving off. And so these small landowners wouldn't be able to go control these elk because the elk wouldn't be on their property for very long at all. So with the help of Steve Denny here and a number of other folks, we put together a little task force and put together a pilot program. And you can see from the chart that starts at the bottom of page 3 and on to 4, specifically it's designed to help on the small acreage elk damage problem we have in southwestern Oregon. So the legislation passed in 2000, I guess it's, I'm looking here, it ends in 2008 and it started in 2003. So essentially, you know, we have 2 full years of data. But when we met with the advisory board to help put this together, the consensus was rather than go for a permanent fix on this bill or maybe think about extending it statewide, it would be best for everyone if we could have a few more years of information measuring success to see whether the program works or doesn't work before we go ahead and continue it in statute. So we're just going to be asking for an extension of this program, and it's strongly supported by the other LedSafe members from southwestern Oregon as well as the sportsmen and landowner communities there. And actually, they'll be here to testify in front of this committee when that bill comes up about the program. And again, if we want to get some specifics of it, Mr. Denny's here, and we can talk about that. And lastly, of course, Representative Boquist, what would a day be without me and you talking about wolves and snow? At the bottom page 4 and into 5, we are coming back with a concept from last session, or kind of where we left off from last session, which is House Bill 2295 for this session. And for those veterans of this Natural Resource Committee, yeah, that's right. It'll be more than a dash 5 by the time we're done on this one, too, I think.
More.
Yeah. But essentially, the Oregon, state of Oregon to the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife has an Oregon Wolf Conservation Management Plan that was adopted in February 2005 by the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission. And that plan was put together essentially with over more than a four-year period of public process, and then at the end, a 16-month advisory group process, professionally facilitated, which was lots of fun, but was a real give and take, and in the end, that group was very successful in putting forth an Oregon Wolf Conservation Management Plan. Part of the plan, which is in rule currently in Oregon Farm Fish and Wildlife Rules, part of the plan had a legislative component that we needed four major concepts to go forward in legislation to help protect landowners and give landowners more tools to protect their private property, particularly livestock, when wolves finally arrived in Oregon. So on the top of page 5, it really lays out the four key concepts that are in this bill, and it is the four key concepts that were in the bill last session. And first of all, it changes the status of gray wolf from protected non-game wildlife, which currently is now, and it's currently on the state threatened and endangered list, to a game animal. And secondly, would authorize the department to issue incidental take permits for the take of wolves while they're on the threatened and endangered list, while trapping for other species involved in livestock damage. It allows the lethal take of wolves by landowners without a permit if a wolf was caught in the act of attacking livestock, and creates a state-sponsored livestock compensation program and proactive trust fund. And it is in the governor's budget for approximately $200,000 as we speak for this fund. So this bill represents the work of lots of folks over a long period of time, but for the veterans here, as I know, it's not quite perfect, and we are busily already negotiating with the various parties to see if we cannot arrive at a bill that everyone from Defenders of Wildlife to Livestock Industry, Hell's Canyon Preservation Council, and others can all come up here and support. And so in our discussions previously with you, Representative Roblin, I wanted to kind of reiterate that it's my responsibility, I feel, to, as best as possible, before this first hearing, come up with a bill that folks can all agree to. And that is kind of what I'd like to do, and what I'm working on currently with the help of Craig Ely and others. So if we have time, Representative, or we can reschedule it, we gave a briefing to our commission today on ongoing wolf activities and things the department's been working on, and the status of wolves in Idaho and other issues. Earlier today, take about 10 minutes, Mr. So I think there's enough interest. I wanted to make that offer. And if you have time, I'd like to do that. If not, we reschedule that, whatever you'd like.
Yeah, I think we have time today.
Okay. Craig, do you want to come up for me?
Sure. Hey, Mr. Chair, I promise not to ask any wolf questions today, but I will be asking a cougar question.
And I do want to say, Mr. Elliker, I have appreciated your willingness to go wherever there are a lot of people gathered upset with each other and to have a level head and continue to work with those groups to come to equally agreeable things at the end of it. And there are a few people who I have seen do it as well. And I've had the opportunity to watch you with STEP programs and other places, and I have been impressed with the skills you have shown in working with groups to try to come to a consensus. So I do appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Roland, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Healy. I'm the Northeast Regional Manager, and I live in La Grande. Earlier today, we discussed with our commissioners a report that was promised to them after we adopted the Wolf Conservation Management Plan in December of 2005 to summarize what we had done up to this point with respect to implementation of the plan. We had five major areas that we reported on today. The first one was the training of some of our personnel so that we get them up to speed on capture techniques so we can handle this endangered species. We've had folks go to some training in Idaho and also in Montana. The second thing was to purchase equipment. As you might expect in handling an endangered species, federally endangered species, and also the state one, we need to be very cautious. Now we proceeded with that, so we have bought some specialized equipment on the advice of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Wildlife Services. In addition to that, the agency applied for a what they call a 10A1A under Section 10 of the Federal Endangered Species Act asking authority for us to be able to lethally take wolves that were causing depredation. They are considering that permit. We haven't heard if they will move forward with that or not, but we did apply for that authority. We do currently have authority to implement capture of a wolf under Section 10. We already have that authority from the federal government to move forward with that. The a third item is one that that we have participated in a number of field investigations looking for wolves when we get these reports. We have 42 wolf reports in the last year. Some of those ones that I guess raised our awareness or considered more investigation, they're listed there in terms of those five bullets. The Chestnut area, we had a video of a black wolf that was taken on the Zumwalt Chestnut area. We investigated that. We never did see the animal, but we showed that to a number of wolf experts, and they told us it probably looked like a wolf. In South Baker County, we've had a number of investigations of tracks and reported sightings. We've been followed up on those. The Eagle Cap Wilderness area is one that we had have some of our biologists at a great deal of distance, a mile and a half, observed what they thought was considered a wolf, acted like a wolf, large animal. And in the Tryon Hills Canyon area, we've had multiple reports. There's a pack of wolves in Idaho within 5 miles of this area, and we continue to get reports from hunters there this fall of other sightings. And then in the East Wenatchee Sled Springs, those are, again, tracks in the snow. In addition to some of the field investigations, we've also taken some roadkill animals and put them out and put video cameras on them, those remote cameras, to see what visits the site. It's really interesting to watch those videos. We've had coyotes come in. We've had cougars come in, skunks, raccoons. We have yet to take a picture of a wolf. So we are investigating these, trying to be aggressive and trying to confirm that we do indeed have wolves in Oregon. What we highly suspect that they're here, but we just cannot tell you with 100% certainty that they are here. The fourth item is a communication and education program that we've initiated with livestock producers. We've been in contact with the Cattlemen's Association and Oregon Sheep Growers. We've tried to create a one-page flyer of information to distribute to them on what their rights and they can and can't do under current federal and state law. And then we've also just conducted a number of key contacts. The other one is with our hunters. We've had a number of articles with Oregon Hunter Association, the Oregon Hunter magazine, and also done a number of interviews and discussions with various groups. And then we've had several contacts and multiple interviews with newspaper and two television interviews. And then the last one is the wolf legislation, and Roy discussed that with you earlier, the four items that we're bringing forward for you today.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Boquist.
Hey, Mr. Chair, I don't have a wolf question, but maybe Roy could just take 2 minutes to update the status and the progress of the Cougar plan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, you know, I could... You know, I think what I'd rather do, if I'd rather bring over some of my Ron Angle, in particular, our wildlife chief. The Cougar plan is moving ahead, and for the members of this commission or committee who are new, last year in 2006, the department went through a rather large public process and made some significant changes to our Oregon Cougar plan by which we manage the cougar species here. And in particular, what we did is we have gone out and used some, I guess for want of a better word, some population modeling and using some techniques I think that are going to be are looked on as pretty kind of new, but also pretty modern by modeling standards. Can't think of the right word, but the bottom line is we are looking to, in a pilot program, we are looking to, how we manage cougars in this state is essentially we do set quotas like we do for a lot of species we manage, and we seek to reach that quota of animals we're removing from the population by a number of means, but most generally through hunting. Hunting and trapping are the tools by which we manage a lot of wildlife populations. But in the case of cougar, for which we have been in this building discussing that species for as long as I've been with the department, since 93 and sessions before that, we have decided to be more proactive in trying to reach our quota numbers of cougars and trying to remove cougars at a rate that allow us to see some success in reducing livestock complaints or in reducing what we are showing by research is some significant damage to some big game herds. So we are moving ahead on the three pilot areas, one in southern Oregon, two in eastern Oregon, and we have divided each area. One is for livestock complaints, one is for big game issues, and one is for human safety. And we already started on that path, and we're going to see how we do. So I guess that's the short of it, Representative Boquist, but I'm very happy to come with a little more prepared presentation to talk about this issue, if you like, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We'll get back to you.
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'll take that as assignment then.
Other questions for the department?
Mr. Chair, just I don't have a question, but I would like it if somebody would maybe come by my office and visit with me regarding the place for Oregonians in the drawing of deer and elk tags.
Sure.
And the current status and also the, any legislative concepts I may have about that on behalf of all of those who still hunt every year like myself.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, be very happy to do that, and I'll go by your office tomorrow and set up a time.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And now we have the Department of Forestry, Marvin Brown, and is Dan with you? Yeah, there you are. Come on up, Dan.
Good afternoon, Chair Roble, members of the committee. I'm Marvin Brown. I'm the director of the Department of Forestry. Dan's going to sit behind me and bail me out if I get in too much trouble today. I think you're getting right now a handout that we've brought to the committee, and the handout just outlines by major program what some legislative concepts we have that have made it through the approval process and have been submitted by the governor. And also, once you get past the legislative concepts in each of these program areas, we've also just outlined a few other issues that may be bubbling up as the legislature goes on this year. And so what I thought I'd do is just very, very briefly hit each of those. And if anybody wants me to stop and talk about any one of them, I'll be happy to try to do that as we go through, if that sounds okay.
Yep.
We have, in the Department of Forestry, most of you I know are aware, but we have three significant programs that we manage. They represent the three main divisions of the department. One division is private forest land management. One is our public land management, publicly owned land management. And the other is our fire protection program. And that's roughly how these legislative concepts and issues are broken out. So the end of the first issue, private forest, we have several what I would call not real controversial legislative concepts. One would just simply make us a permanent member of the state's Invasive Species Council. It's not not a big, complicated issue, just something we feel like we need to be a part of. It's a significant issue for forest lands in the state. The second legislative concept, HB 2293, is our attempts to try to improve an existing program that's on the statutes. It's a program that was intended to encourage land that's currently underforested. I guess I would say it's land that has not been reforested successfully. It's a program to try to encourage landowners to bring that back into forest. It's not been a very successful program since its inception, and we're just trying to make some changes that might improve the success. We also, for a long time, HB 2069 on page 2, we have implemented a tree improvement seed bank program for a number of years, and this amendments to that authority would simply give us an ability to add an extra charge to the seed that we sell, and that extra charge would be used for some developmental opportunities to get more involved in tree improvement genetic kinds of work and on behalf of landowners. By the same token, we have had a statute that implements what we call a stewardship program for a number of years, and it also has not been a very successful program for a number of reasons, and we are trying to propose some changes that we think could make it more attractive to landowners. Under the other issues category, biomass is an opportunity in the state that we think is a very positive one, and this issue will bubble up more in our budget request, where we have requested some positions to get more involved in promoting biomass utilization. The second issue there, field capacity. Representative Smith was kind enough to lead some really, I think, productive discussions during the interim with our department and with the Board of Forestry about the fact that we have lost a lot of field capacity over the last several budget sessions that would help us implement the private lands program, and that's significant enough. I wanted to bring it up here too. We the way that I've described it before is that I think one thing that has made our forest practices program in the state of Oregon successful is we've really tried to put a focus on putting people out on the ground that can help people be successful, help forest landowners be successful, as opposed to creating a bunch of laws and regulations that are there to kind of catch people being unsuccessful. But in order to be out there and to help people achieve that level of success, we need the bodies, and we've lost significant of those bodies over the last 6 years, and so field capacity is an issue for us that we hope gets some attention. By the same token, monitoring, in order to implement a good law that requires landowners to do specific things as they manage their forest lands, we need the scientific data that says, in fact, those measures are effective. And so we will be talking a lot about our ability to monitor forest practices over time. And community forestry, this is a new initiative that we hope to have some really good conversations with the legislature as time goes on here. I've had a chance, and staff have had a chance to talk with a couple of three of you to this point, and we'll be talking with more. But as Oregon's population gets more urban, as there's more people in the state, there's more pressure to develop forest land, for that land to become something other than a working forest. And we feel like right now, you know, that pressure is pretty much inevitable. The population is going to continue to increase. But we don't have a programmatic approach that really focuses on that. We have our programmatic approach right now is based on a state policy that says that private forest lands is for the growing and harvesting of timber. And our forest practices rules and all the law follows from that. But in fact, a lot of these issues that we get involved in that relate to land conversion are not about growing and harvesting timber anymore. They're about land conversion, and we simply need a better programmatic approach to deal with that than we have right now. So we've kind of put that out on the table as something we'd really like to have some good discussion with the legislature about this year. If I could, I'd move on to the second program area, and that's public lands. We have a bill. It was introduced last session and eventually was kind of taken off the table. We'd like to bring it back. It is a bill that would give us the authority to seek revenue bonds that we would use the money to purchase properties. The way I describe this is kind of viewing the Department of Forestry as the purchaser of last resort. when there's a significant tract of land out there, anything from 30,000 to 100,000 or more acres that we know is at danger of being moved from a working forest into some other kind of ownership. You know, talking to folks in those situations, they feel like public ownership is one way to keep that as a working forest, and right now we don't have the authority to really raise the capital that will allow us to do that, and that's what this bill does. And it also ties back in then, as we would manage that land for revenue, we would use the revenue to cover our management costs, we'd use the revenue to obviously pay off the bond, and then over time, as the bond was paid off, the revenue would be allocated to supporting higher education. And that's a concept that the governor has asked us to pursue. Other public lands issues. Federal lands is significant, is a significant issue in the state. There's a number of things going on there that try to interject the state more into decision making as it relates to federal lands. And Chair Roblin and I have talked about possibly bringing back to the committee a full-blown presentation about all those things, and we hope we get the opportunity to do that. We, as you know, manage several hundred thousand acres that are called Board of Forestry lands, where the revenues are allocated to county governments. And there is ongoing review about the performance of those lands, whether or not, in fact, they are generating sufficient revenue. And it comes up every session. I'm sure it's going to come up this session again, so we'll see what happens there. And as Chair Roblin's aware, we're also in the middle of revising the Elliott State Forest Plan. The revisions that we've put together at this point would, and the Elliott State Forest funds for that, if you don't know, excess funds move into the Common School Fund program. So, but our management plan that we have proposed at this point would increase harvests from the current level by about 50%. It would increase, result in a 50% increase in harvest levels over the current level. And there's folks who would like to see that be more. In fact, they're talking more like 120%. So it's certainly an issue that you all will probably hear before it's all over. Move from public lands to fire protection. That is our other significant program, and in fact, it's the largest program in the department. There is a bill that was passed in 1997 called Senate Bill 360, which really directs us to work in the urban interface areas where residential properties and forest properties are starting to become more and more intermixed, and develop plans that help manage the fire risk in those areas better. As we've implemented that program in four or five counties around the state, we've learned quite a bit, and this bill here would simply try to create some improvement in that current program. On to House Bill 2067. There is a current statute that dictates how fire costs are shared between landowners and the state's general fund. That cost share agreement was only in place for 2 years. If we want to maintain it as it is now, it needs to be reauthorized, and our legislative concept recommends that it is reauthorized as it has been for the last 2 years. Other issues in fire, with the federal government owning 60% of the forest land, there's always issues around cooperation between our fire protection capacity and theirs, and we think we've made some good progress there, but it's an ongoing effort to deal with. Smoke management, we are responsible for approving prescribed burning in forested tracts, and we have developed a new smoke management plan that's making its way through the rules process right now. We also have had discussions with our constituents about how to fund that program more effectively, and I think that'll probably come before the legislature at some time. And there are, in parts of the state, where predominantly rangelands versus forest lands that, in fact, don't have any formal fire protection right now. And we have implemented a program to try to bring more of those lands under some kind of a protection association. And there's some concepts out there about how we could do that more effectively that I think might be coming before the legislature. And then beyond just our three programs, there's some general administrative issues. Every session, the legislature is asked to reauthorize the harvest tax. Because the harvest tax, by statute, is associated with specific percentage shares between general fund and harvest tax, we never really know what the harvest tax recommendation is going to be until pretty much towards the end of the session. This is just a standard bill that deals with that question. And then on to other issues. These are not particularly exciting ones, but they're important. We have in our budget request a fairly significant dollar amount to upgrade business systems and technology. That's an area where I think we are pretty woefully inadequate right now. And we are also participating very diligently in the discussions statewide to improve disaster communications in disaster situations. It's called the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network. We have one of the more extensive radio networks in the state, and so we're going to be a significant piece of that. So that's just an extremely fast overview of things that are on the plate right now. I'm sure there'll be more.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Green, what's the status of our fire insurance?
Chair Roland and Representative Boquist, the fire insurance is something that we purchase every year. We have received the appropriation from the E-Board to purchase it again this year.
Okay. And that is in part of the 2067, about $15 million. Is that part of that whole process?
In terms of the bill that's listed here as a legislative
concept? Yeah, fire protection cost.
Actually, it's not. It's an area that's kind of I haven't figured out the systematic way that this gets discussed yet myself. But every session there is within the E-Board a designated special appropriations amount that's there for us to draw on if fire conditions get so bad that we need to add some extra resources. We call it severity funding. And within that special appropriation has usually been the dollars to purchase insurance as well. And that special appropriation has always just sort of surfaced and become part of the discussion as the session goes along. It's the landowners' agreement with passage of this legislative concept has always been contingent on the state's willingness to purchase that insurance payment, and that's certainly, I would not want to speak for them, but I would assume that they still feel that way, but it's not actually a part of the legislative concept.
Paul, Mr. Chair, so then have we bound the policy for this next fire season, or you're still negotiating with the underwriters?
Chair Roblin and Representative Boquist, I think we're still negotiating right now. We do have the funds to purchase it, but we haven't actually made the purchase yet, I don't think.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, I mean, as you recall, we went through this last time, and as time progressed, insurance got more expensive. So the earlier we bind the policy with the underwriters, the better the protection we have for the state of Oregon, and less chance you'll have to come back and get more money from us. So.
And I think that it's important to understand we are the only state that can continue to buy that insurance policy because of the connection that we've made at fighting fires, which is in large part what this whole issue with 2067 does, is make sure the money is there. There's a commitment from landowners to share in that as well as the state, and that combination has kept us in the neighborhood to actually buy a policy which gives us that little break to that next $25 million, I believe, in costs. And we haven't really had to exceed that because of that insurance policy.
Yeah, Chair, you're exactly right. It's been a very effective program.
Other questions? Yes.
Mr. Brown, on the IT-related, I'm on the Ways and Means sub as well, so are those a lot of those systems here in Salem? You're on State Street?
Chair Roblin, I'm Representative Clem. Yes, we are. And most of that is central office systems. They're systems related to the basic transactions and record keepings that go with our different business segments, mm-hmm. like selling timber and managing receipts there. And the fire program, we may get revenue coming from the Forest Service, from the Federal Emergency Management Agency. We get money from the state. We get money from landowners. We have cooperative agreements with fire departments who are not actually state agencies and share dollars. And it becomes an incredibly complicated transaction system. And frankly, our systems aren't, our technology systems aren't keeping up with it. I tell this story. I went to our John Day office. I've only been in this position for about 3.5 years, and the first winter I went to our John Day office and went upstairs and looked in an empty room up there, and there were three piles of boxes of paper, and each pile of paper was about the size of this desk, and each one of those was all of the record keeping that still had to be gone through and reconciled for three project fires that we'd had that summer, and it was all just big piles of paper, and I think we can do a lot better than that.
Mr. Chair, I just wondered if maybe you could go by my office at some point or call over and set up a time for me to come out there just so I can get some advanced knowledge and understanding. It's easy for me to see things sometimes, and I do own a computer repair business, so sometimes I can look at things and grasp things better in terms of how old those things really are and that type of deal.
I appreciate that. I have an appointment the 25th, okay. And you are my representative, so I knew that.
Yeah, it's in my district. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And I'd like to try and go over there, too, at some point and see things firsthand.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Just a note, right now we are planning on having hearings on 2067 and 2068 next Tuesday, so you might look at those in between. 67 and 68. So two of the ones we just talked about.
That would be next Tuesday?
Next Tuesday.
And 68.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other business for our committee? Seeing none, we will close the committee. And thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.